x prime, which is equal to r times x, r being a rotation matrix. Some element of SO3 in the way that we described yesterday. But what happens in quantum mechanics if we want to rotate a state? Well, the easiest way to do this is just to say that if you have a rotation which acts in this kind of way, turns x into x prime, then you would like to associate that with an operator u of r, which when acting on some state psi gives you the rotated state psi, where this is going to be rotated through some angle theta about an axis ni in the usual way. So this will be the rotated state. So the question is how to define that. My guess is that there are really many ways of doing this, but the easiest way to get to the bottom grips with the whole thing is to say, well, there is, in fact, a simple way of describing x. You could calculate the expectation value in the rotated state of the operator x. This thing, that ought to be the same thing as rotating x on the assumption that the expectation value of x in the original state gives you x. So this simply says, if you perform this rotation on the state, calculate the expectation value of x, you get the rotated value of x. So that's what you mean by a rotation. What does that mean for you? This means that you can figure out what u has got to be by plugging in this result into here. Now we know what it is if you act on the ket, so the bra is going to be just the Hermitian conjugate of this thing, so psi r is going to be equal to psi and then u dagger of r, so it's just going to be the Hermitian conjugate. And so if you plug this and that into this expression, you will end up with so let's see, we get psi r x hat psi r. That's the same thing as psi u dagger of r x hat u of r psi. And this thing has got to be the same thing as r acting, well, has got to be the same thing as psi r x hat acting on psi. R is just a C number, and so it can be taken inside it. So that tells us that we can figure out what U has got to be by comparing the two things. This has got to be true for all psi. So this means that u dagger of r, x hat, u of r is equal to r acting on the operator x hat. So all you really need to do is to now figure out what that has got to be. So let's do this infinitesimally to start with. So we want to consider an infinitesimal rotation of theta about an axis n. Then the right-hand side of this thing is just going to be rij xj hat, which is the same thing as delta ij minus I epsilon ijk nk times theta acting on xj. So that's going to be the right-hand side. What about the left-hand side? Well, I'm going to make a prescient guess and show that this works. So I'm going to guess that infinitesimally, u of r is going to be equal to 1 minus, let me guess right, I over h bar li ni theta. Is that what I mean? Yes, that is what I mean. And then there will be terms of order theta squared. So that's my guess. What you need to do now is to show that this actually gives you the right answer. So what you need to do is to show that u dagger x u reproduces this object down here. So let's do that. Let's calculate u dagger, the Hermitian conjugate of u. The 1 goes to a 1, minus I goes to plus I. Li dagger is the same thing as Li, because Li is the angular momentum operator, and it's an observable, and therefore is Hermitian. And then there are terms of order theta squared. So let's calculate u dagger x u. That's going to be 1 plus I over h bar Li ni theta plus stuff that I don't care about at the moment, x. I guess I have an index problem. I would like this to be xj, because I want to end up having something which looks like rij xj. No, I think it would be xi, I'm sorry. Which means I can't use i's here, but I better use something else. So let's call these j's. And then to the right, you've got u, which is 1 minus I over h bar L k n k theta, again, plus higher order stuff. Now let's evaluate this. To order 0 in theta, there's just one term, and that's xi. To order 1 in theta, there is this term with that one, and this term with that one, and then all other terms are higher order in theta. So what you will end up with is plus I over h bar theta. There's an I over h bar theta there. Then you've got L j n j x I from that term with the one. Then you've got the same thing with the opposite kind of order here. There's one xi and this, with a minus sign. So take out the factor of I h bar and the theta, and you have a minus xi, and then there's an lk nk, but it might look a little bit better if I change that to lj nj. Then there's terms which are higher order in theta squared. So now we've just got a commutator of two things. There's going to be an nj, and then the commutator of lj with xi. And then there's some higher order stuff. We already know the representation of the angular momentum operator on the space of all functions. So let's use that explicitly. Let's do this over here. Li we know to be equal to minus I h bar epsilon I j k x j dk when acting on the space of all functions. So we need to calculate the commutator of lj with xi. So that's really the commutator of, well, the IH bar and epsilon I, well, let me see, we've got too many j's and k's here. So we want lj, first of all, so let's move these letters all up by one. So lj, l, m, x, l, d, m. And then you just have an xi. So you get that commutator. There will be three terms acting in this. Do I need to write this out, or shall I just simply tell you what the answer is? I mean, I don't know whether you're used to working these things out or not. Straight to the answer. All right. The only term that contributes is this operator acting on the xi, which gives me a delta im. So this is going to be epsilon j l m x l delta I m. All the other terms go away. Delta I m epsilon j l m gives me epsilon j l I x l. So that's going to be this commutator that we need here. So if we plug this in, you'll get x I plus I over h bar theta n j. Lj with xi we decided was minus I h bar. Epsilon j l I x l. And then the higher order stuff. And so this expression here is supposed to be the same thing as this thing. So let's write out what it is. Let's see if it really works. Xi, well, that's obviously right. There's a plus I over h bar and a minus I times h bar. So that's just a 1. So there's a plus theta nj epsilon jli and xl. And that's it, plus higher order stuff. So is this equal to this? And the answer had better be yes. We seem to have lost an I. Why is there an I in here? Someone should have told me there should not. I don't think there's supposed to be an I in this, is there? Should never have been there. But let's see if our indices have worked out right. The I comes first, so if I send this I to the front, I get IJL, NJ. Yes, so the answer is yes, because the indices go in the opposite order here, so we do get what we want. So infinitesimally, the rotation operator is given by this. If you need to do a finite rotation, you can do the same kind of thing.
Able to make such a wonderful guess to start with, how did you go about figuring that?
Well, usually the way in which you do these is by brute force. You just try all the kinds of things that would work. But what you might not realize is that you have to involve a unitary operator U. So historically, I don't actually know how it was done. My guess is that you just simply guessed.
Object, right? And that should correspond to.
I think the answer is historically no, because I don't think the significance of unitary operators acting on state functions was known widely until Dirac wrote his book, which was 1931. Whereas this was understood in the 1920s, so I think it must have been done a different way. So I'm skeptical about that. That's not to say wrong, it's just that I don't know, but I'm skeptical. I think it was probably done by Figner or Bohr, probably in a rather clunky way, and eventually sort of streamlined into something that looks like this. You have to remember that most of these quantum mechanical things were worked out pre-Dirac, and it wasn't until the state vectors and unitary operators became commonplace that it was easy to do these. So I don't mean to pour cold water on this suggestion, but I'm not sure I really believe it. For finite rotation, it is the case that U of R is equal to the exponential of minus I over h bar L I n I theta. So that if I calculate u dagger x u, this will be equal to r times x for finite rotations. I'm going to leave that as a problem to do for this afternoon. Because this is sort of kind of central to the whole thing. So I'll leave that to you. It's a little involved, but not so much fun to do on the board yourself. But you need to try it and make sure you can make it work. There are various tricks that you could use. So you can see if you can remember or invent some tricks, specifically involving doing things with theta, and give it a go and see what happens. You can also work out the effect of rotations on operators. We now have to rotate states. So suppose, for example, I calculate the expectation value of some operator O. And I can form a rotation on the state and on the operator. And calculate this object. I use the letter O because I have in mind here something observable. So this is an operator which corresponds. I'll put a hat on it. Often I lose the connection between operators and functions, but I'll try to be consistent about it. So it's an observable, therefore it's an emission. If I rotate the state, therefore basically I rotated the thing that I'm going to perform an observation on. If I rotated the observable operator, that means I've rotated whatever measuring apparatus I'm using, and in fact the entire system. But since the answer that you get for an observation cannot possibly depend on the coordinates that you have used to do the measurement, this object, which is just the same thing in a rotated coordinate system has got to be the same as this. So as long as O is a Hermitian operator corresponding to something which is observable, this must hold, and it must hold for arbitrary psi. That means that we can deduce what the rotated version of an operator is going to be. This expression here, psi r, O rotated psi r, is the same thing as psi, U dagger of r, O rotated U of r acting on psi. But this thing has got to be equal to psi operator psi for all psi. So it follows from that that U dagger of R, O R U of R is equal to the operator O. Or if you prefer it, the rotated version of the operator. Well, since U is unitary, remember that we discovered that U was equal to E to the minus I over 2 Li theta I theta Ni. That's unitary. Fairly obviously, because if I take U dagger, this thing will be the exponential of the minus I goes to a plus I, L I goes to Li dagger, but that's Hermitian. So it goes to this, theta Ni, and then that times that is equal to 1. So the way in which you figure out what this is to pre-multiply by U and post-multiply by U dagger. So you get U dagger, OR, U dagger, is equal to U, O, U dagger, and that thing is the same as OR, because this thing is 1, and that thing is 1. So you have here a formula for the rotated version of any observable operator. You'll notice, of course, that this thing is Hermitian, because if O is Hermitian, then OR is Hermitian. Perhaps we should prove that. Well, OR, we said, was equal to U, O, U dagger. So OR dagger is equal to, you just go backwards, U double dagger, which is U, O dagger, U dagger, but O is observable, so O dagger is O. So that is also consistent. So that really amounts to all I really want to say about rotations at the moment. Sure, yes, sorry.
Shouldn't there be an
H-bar? Oh, yeah, H-bar on the bottom. Why did I put a 2 here? I was thinking about, well, you all know what I was thinking. Yes, that's better. That's all I really want to say about rotations, at least for the time being.
Sorry, I couldn't see some of that.
Oh, what do we need to fix?
I just needed to write down U and U dagger there.
Oh, I see.
And I couldn't see that last whole bit where you're great.
This bit?
No, I can write it from that.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, if I erase something too quickly, do tell me, because I might. It's easy enough to do. Well, we're talking here about angular momentum. The angular momentum operator showed up as being somehow essential to deal with the question of rotation. This I can get rid of, I guess. There's something very peculiar about the angular momentum operator. We know that there is angular momentum in quantum mechanics coming simply from the orbital angular momentum. And we have everything that we've said so far is based on the fact that the angular momentum operator is R cross P. And therefore what we're dealing with is how wave functions and states and operators transform under spatial rotation. And we have learnt that it's related to angular momentum. What is extraordinary about things that happen in quantum mechanics is that angular momentum can arise from two distinct sources. Angular momentum can arise from the intrinsic properties of the particle itself. So, for example, an electron has some angular momentum associated with it. You can figuratively regard this as being like a ball that is spinning and therefore comes with some angular momentum. But the strange thing is, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. The angular momentum is precisely fixed to be equal to whatever it is. The spin angular momentum is not something which can be changed. But it's something intrinsic to the particle. So it's really stuck to the particle. It labels some properties of the particle itself. From the point of view of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, this is entirely and utterly mysterious. It's just a hypothesis. However, in relativistic quantum mechanics, or quantum field theory, it becomes entirely and utterly natural. But unfortunately, to do that requires us to study the Dirac equation, and I will do that either next week or the week after. But from the point of view of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is what we're doing at the moment, we're kind of stuck. Which is simply regarding this as an additional postulate. The reason that this postulate came about was trying to understand historically, it came from studying the Zeeman effect. I guess everyone knows what that is, hopefully. Protest now if you do not. Good. What was noticed there was that there was some lines in hydrogen. So here is some state. I guess one sort of decays by some photon emission process. But if you apply a magnetic field, what you discovered was that the state split into two. Now, I guess we all know that if you have charged particles that are undergoing some kind of rotational motion, then applying a magnetic field will change the energy. So if you wanted to say, well, you split one state into two, you're a bit stuck if you're just stuck with ordinary orbital angular momentum. That's because you'd expect it to split into three or five, or stay where it is. That's because for states of orbital angular momentum L, there are two L plus one states. And so if you see something like this happening in the Zeeman effect, you would say, well, 2L plus 1 is equal to 2, therefore L is equal to a half. And you'd wonder what was going on, because we've already seen that wave functions with spin half are pathological. So for this reason, Uhlenbeck and Goudschmidt invented the concept of intrinsic spin. So this is really due to them. And that was in 1925, way before the Dirac equation, which explained what was going on. So they just simply said, there will be properties of particles that, where they have spin, and spin behaves just like angular momentum. Except that it is not associated with a wave function with space dependence. So there are two kinds of angular momentum that you find in quantum mechanics. That associated with orbits is usually called L. That associated with the intrinsic spin is usually called S. The total angular momentum is usually called J. J is, in some sense, the sum of the two, I'm going to write that in inverted commas because I haven't told you yet how to take the sum of two different kinds of angular momentum. J, being composed of these things, can also have spin half. So that J can take the values 0, 1, half, 1, 3 halves, 2, all the things that you had from orbital angular momentum, but odd half integers as well. The projection of J into, say, the Z direction, let's call that M, will take values which lie in integer steps from plus J to minus J. Similarly, the eigenvalues of J squared are J into J plus 1 times H bar squared. But I want to emphasize that it was just a hypothesis that this really does work. So let's make a formal statement of what this hypothesis is. Consider any state. Psi. Under rotations, psi goes to psi rotated, which is equal to U of R acting on psi, where now U of R is equal to the exponential of minus I over H bar JI NI theta, where JI is the total angular momentum of that state. That includes the spin path and the spatial angular momentum. Now, I guess we all know that electrons have spin half, so we need to know how that fits into this kind of picture. So, following I guess the following was invented by Pauli. And 3/2 and 5/2, etc. systems in terms of operators J. You simply assume that the J's obey the same algebra as the L's. So that if you calculate the commutator of two J's, you get epsilon times J with a factor of I. However, if you're interested in representations, of course, J squared is still a Casimir operator. So the question is, can you find representations of these J's that have the two states that correspond to the intrinsic spin of the electron? We already know something about the representations of this algebra. We've found the vector representation. We have found a representation that acts on the space of all functions. We have implicitly found representations that have integer angular momentum. Which we describe by the states L and M, or the wave functions YLM of theta and phi. So the next obvious step is, can we find a two-dimensional one corresponding to spin half? To which the answer is yes. So let me just write down what they are. They usually go by the name as Pauli matrices. Sigma, usually called Pauli matrices. And a very convenient representation of them, the one that is used everywhere, is 0, 1, 1, 0. Sigma y is 0 minus ii, 0. Sigma z is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. And if you plug them into this commutation rule, you will discover they do what you want. If you really wanted to get to the J's by rescaling the physical angular momentum, I think I'd like to put in a factor of H bar in this expression. So forgive me for forgetting it. I should say that I often forget factors of h bar for the simple reason that it's convenient to work in units such that h bar is equal to 1, where you never have to worry about these things. But I think that being proper, we should really keep that for a moment. So the physical angular momentum is just a rescaled version of this. So that the JIs are equal to a half of H bar sigma I. Now, if you don't believe that that has total angular momentum 1/2, let's do the following calculation. Let's work out what JX squared plus JY squared plus JZ squared is. So there will be, from squaring each of these things, a quarter of h bar squared. And then you've got sigma x squared plus sigma y squared plus sigma z squared. If you square any of these matrices, well, this one is obviously 1. That one is 1. And that one is 1. So you'll end up with 3. So if I try to interpret that as j into j plus 1 times h bar squared, then j equals a half gives me a half here and a 3/2 there. So I really do get 3/4. So this does correspond to angular momentum 1/2. Yeah. Oh. I could do either, but the point about J is that I don't care where it's come from. I could have done it in terms of S if I wanted to. Actually, perhaps I should have done.
No, I'm just trying to understand.
Spin half always comes from an intrinsic spin S, so perhaps it might have been better to say write it in terms of the S's. But I really wanted to emphasize that it's J that is the physical variable. You always sort of understand that it's coming from, I mean, you measure it. It's rotations that tell you that you've got to spin half. And there it's J that's important. I regard J and S somewhat interchangeable. So you just have to take it from the context that you find it. Spin half, you see, is a very nice thing to think of. Because if we've got this representation, then the eigenvectors, say for example of JZ, are kind of easy. Well, those are the eigenvectors of half H bar sigma Z, which is just this object. So if you want to have plus half H bar in the Z direction, then that corresponds to state 1, 0. And if you want minus half H bar in the Z direction, you can write that as 0. One with index downstairs, with the downstairs thing there. If you want to work out a rotation, it's kind of easy to do that. So let's look at explicit forms of rotations. Well, that was u equals the exponential of minus I over h bar j I n I theta, or s if you wanted to do that. J I was a half h bar sigma I. So you can stick this in here, and you'll get exponential of minus I over 2. H bars cancel, sigma I n I theta. Now, if you want to work out the exponential of some matrix, we already know how to do that. You just simply say this is, if this is the matrix M, then this is equal to 1 plus M plus a half of M squared plus a sixth of M cubed plus dot, 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 dot. So if you expand this out, you will get 1 minus I over 2 sigma I n I theta. Then the next term here actually turns out to be amazingly simple. Let's work out what it is. It's going to be 1 half of m squared. So it's minus I over 2 n I sigma I theta all squared. So minus I gives me squared, so you end up with minus 1 over 8 n I sigma I all squared theta squared. But let's look at sigma I squared. Well, let's work out what that thing is, first of all. We had sigma x is 0, 1, 1, 0. Sigma y is 0, minus I, 0. Sigma z is 1, 0, 0, minus I. And if you think about that, the product of any two sigmas is delta ij plus I epsilon ijk sigma k. Does that need any explanation? It's kind of obvious. The symmetric part is this one, and the antisymmetric part is that one. We've already worked out the commutator, so that bit is kind of obvious. So this thing is going to be minus 1/8 nij sigma I sigma j theta squared. This works out the symmetric part of sigma I sigma j. So this is minus 1/8 n I n j delta I j theta squared. But n is a unit vector, so n I n j delta I j is just equal to 1. So the next term you end up with here is minus 1 over 8 theta squared. Now let's look at the m cubed term. That must be proportional to sigma I n I, because it's m squared times m. So all the odd terms are proportional to sigma I n I. And all the even terms are proportional to 1. So actually, assembling up the whole thing is not too complicated. So you will get cos of 1/2 theta. If you don't believe me, you can work out the higher order terms yourself. But it's kind of obvious, because this is minus something, and a half theta squared is a quarter theta squared times a half is an eighth, so that's the right kind of thing. And then there will be minus an I sigma I n I sine of a half theta. So that's the rotation matrix. You will notice something weird about this notation, rotation matrix. If you send theta to theta plus 2 pi, let's not do it that way. Just put theta equal to 2 pi. In other words, I perform one complete rotation. Then cos of a half theta is equal to minus 1. Sine of a half theta is equal to 0. So u of r is equal to minus 1. In other words, the rotated state is minus itself. This is the reflection of the pathology that we found before, where you had double-valuedness. But here it doesn't cause you a problem. It just simply says that if you perform a rotation on the state changes sign. It does not tell you that some function in space changes sign. So this does not involve anything weird and double-valued. It just simply tells you about how a state vector has transformed. Suppose now you do two rotations. You put theta equal to 4 pi, then u of r is equal to plus 1, and you get back to where you started from. So this thing that the state rotates into minus itself is the sort of key signature that you have something fermionic going on. How much time have I got left? 14 minutes, it's not enough. So that's how you deal with spin half, and it's a spin half representations that we have just found. So we can do problem 2. So I hope you guys can solve this by this afternoon. Find the spin 3/2 representation. Of the spin algebra. Spin 3/2 has got 2 times 3/2 plus 1 equals 4 degrees of freedom. So whatever this is, has got to be 4 by 4 matrices that obey the same algebra. I will leave it to you to figure out how to do that. So that was a lightning introduction to spin. There are all kinds of interesting problems to deal with spin, and we will come across some, I think, probably, well, very soon, where you use spin half. Spin half is always easier to deal with than spin one, so usually one deals with spin half as examples because it's sort of easy and tractable. So now we need to deal with some technology to do with the properties of systems of various kinds of angular momentum. So what I want to do first was raising and lowering operators. Now, you could do this. Using wave functions, but it is amazingly complicated and unpleasant. I really don't want to do that. It's always best done by using abstract algebraic concepts. So our sort of starting point will be that we know that whatever the origin of spin, of the angular momentum, whether it be from intrinsic spin or orbital angular momentum, we have a set of states J and M such that if J squared acts on it, you get J into J plus 1 H bar squared times JM. If JZ acts on state JM, you get M H bar times JM. And you know that the J's obey the angular momentum algebra. JI commuted with JJ is equal to I H bar epsilon IJK JK. And of course, J can be integer or half integer. And M runs from plus J to minus J in integer steps. So that's really the starting point. There are a collection of operators. I think that I saw some of this on the board yesterday afternoon, so I don't know quite what you did. Sorry? Ah, okay. So I can do this very quickly, I guess. In that case.
Well, we've got the formula out of thin air, but...
You quoted them rather than...
Yeah.
Okay. I can't remember what these formulae are. So if I want to use them, I always have to derive. The way to do it is to invent two operators, J plus and J minus. These are Jx plus I, J, Y, Jx minus I, J, Y. These are not observable because they are not emissions. If you calculate the Hermitian conjugate of J plus, you'll end up with J minus. So they're not things that you can observe. Now, it's going to be very useful for us to try and construct a table of useful properties of J plus and J minus. So the very first thing that I want to do is to calculate JZ commuted with J plus. We really know how to do all of these calculations. It's not hard. JZ commuted with J plus is JZ commuted with JX plus IJY. JZ commuted with JX is IH bar times JY. JZ commuted with JY is minus IH bar times JX. So I end up with that, which can more appropriately be written as H bar into J plus. That was easy. Let's do the same thing for J minus. JZ commuted with J minus is JZ commuted with JX minus IJY. This is JZ commuted with JX is JY, just as before. Here, the only difference is you get plus IJX. So this is equal to minus H bar times J minus. Next, there is J plus with J minus. That's JX plus IJY commuted with JX minus IJY. There are only two interesting terms here. JX, of course, commutes with itself. So you're going to get minus IJX commutator with JY. And then JY commuted with JX, so I get plus I times JY commuted with JX. And then I get JY commuted with JY, which is nothing. These two terms conspire to give me the same thing, because if I swap around the Y and the X here, I'll get a minus sign for interchanging the order in the commutator. So this is minus 2 jx commuted with jy. But jx commuted with jy is ih bar jz. So this is equal to 2h bar jz. What else do I need to know? The next thing it's kind of nice to know is what is the commutator of j plus with j squared? Well, you can just substitute in j squared equals jx squared plus jy squared plus jz squared if you want, but that's a mess. The easiest way to figure out what this commutator is to invent a trick. J squared is jx squared plus jy squared plus jz squared. Now, it would be much easier, since we have a nice table of things here, if we just use j plus and j minus and jz to write out what this is. But if you square j plus, you'll end up with things that look like jx squared minus jy squared, which really isn't what you want at all. So the trick is to write these things in terms of j plus times j minus. J plus times j minus is equal to jx plus ijy times jx minus ijy. And that's almost what you want for two of these terms. There's a jx squared, then there's an ijyjx, then there's a minus ijxjy plus jy squared. There is one thing which is absolutely counterintuitive about this formula. Everybody, at least once in their lives, but only hopefully once, we'll square this and say it's jx squared plus jy squared. It's not. There's a commutator term, because that times that is not the same as that times that. But it's a commutator of something nice. It's minus I times jx commuted with jy. Which is just equal to jz. So this is jx squared plus jy squared plus h bar jz. So the easy way to write this is not like that, but to say that this is equal to j plus times j minus minus h bar jz plus jz squared. And then it's much easier to work out what this commutator is. Yes?
Would it be easier to say that j squared commutes with jx and ky, so it commutes
with j plus? Like directly in the first commutator?
I guess we could do something like that. This is the way I wanted to do it. So the question is, why didn't I want to do that?
So is it?
So it is zero. He's absolutely right. I think I don't need this in some other context.
To normalize the raised
yes,
and lowered.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
And then I can do the same thing with J minus. Now I look lost. Is there anything else that I need? No. Right. So now I think we're in a position where we can actually work out what some of these things do for you. Let's look at the state J plus acting on J pen. There's some new state, and it might be nice to know which J values and M values. Well, if you add the J squared on this, since J plus and J squared commute, you end up with this.
we did the same thing, and j is going plus 1, and h bar squared is going plus, acting on j then. And the same is obviously true for minus. So if you act with j plus or minus on some particular state, it does not change the total angular momentum. Now let's look at JZ acting on J plus. JM. You need to know what the commutator of JZ with J plus is. And we didn't have that, but we just erased it. You can look at your notes, I have to look at mine. So you'll get J plus and JZ plus H bar JZ. H bar J plus acting on JM. JZ acting on JM gives me an M. So this is equal to M plus 1, H bar, J plus, acting on JM. In other words, J plus raises the Z component of the angular momentum by 1 unit. Similarly, if you work out JZ acting on J minus acting on JM, this will be equal to J minus JZ minus H bar JZ acting on JM, which is equal to M minus 1 H bar J minus acting on JM. So J minus lowers it by 1 unit. We can put them both together. One way of thinking about J plus and J minus is that it simply is something which does that. It carries 1 unit of angular momentum either in the up or the down direction, depending on what you mean. It's a sort of intuitive way of thinking about what this thing is. Now, this doesn't tell us everything about this state because we need to know about the normalization of it. What this tells us is that if J plus acts on the state Jn, it's proportional to the state Jn plus 1. It does not tell us that lambda is non-zero. It could be absolutely anything. There is no reason why this state should be normalized. All you've done is you've shown it in some state. This state is normalized. It does not mean that the thing on the right-hand side is normalized. So let's calculate the norm of this state. Let's see. In other words, calculate lambda plus. We know that if you calculate mod, well, let's see, let's take the Michelin conjugate of this. It's Jm, J minus is equal to lambda plus star, Jm plus 1. So we can now take the norm of the whole thing. Jm, J minus, J plus, acting on Jm, is equal to the square modulus of lambda plus squared times j m plus 1, j m plus 1. But this thing is 1 because that state actually is normalized. So you end up with that. Now let's look at this object j minus j plus. This is what I just worked out, but the wrong way round. So let's work out what that one is.
J minus J plus is equal to JX minus IJY times JX plus IJY, which is equal to JX squared plus JY squared plus I times the commutator of JX with JY, which is equal to JX squared plus JY squared minus plus, minus H bar JZ equals big J squared minus JZ squared minus H bar JZ. And that's a convenient way of calculating what this thing is. So this is JM into J squared minus JZ squared minus H bar JZ acting on JM. J squared acting on this gives me a J into J plus 1. There's an overall factor of H bar squared. This gives me a minus M squared. That gives me a minus M. So you get minus M into M plus 1. So now you know what lambda plus is. Lambda plus is equal up to a phase factor to J into J plus 1 minus M into M plus 1. Typically, you take this phase factor to be equal to 1, but that's just a question of convention. An H bar, absolutely. So it's conventional that you take this thing to be positive square root. So you will notice that if you try to raise the state JJ to get yourself something which looks like J into J plus 1, which you think ought to be impossible because there is no such state, you put M equal to J and so you'll get 0 here. So that does make sense. In fact, that's a quick way of figuring out what this coefficient should be. Because if you can't remember it, you know it's got to look something like that, and it's got to be 0 when j equals m. You can do the same calculation for j minus. J minus acting on the state jm is equal to lambda minus times jm minus 1. And you can work out that lambda minus is, by the same argument, the square root of j into j plus 1. Get this right, minus m into m minus. I'll have to look it up, I can never remember it. It's m into m minus 1. Yeah, that's right. I'm writing it down right. So that if you put m equal to minus j, you try to lower the state to give you something times j minus 1. Again, you will get a 0 sitting here, because if you put n equal to minus j, then here you'll get minus j minus 1, and here you'll get a plus j, so these two terms cancel. And that's actually the quickest way of remembering what it actually is. I guess since it is now 22 minutes past, we ought to stop. Yes?
Algebra of the Pauli matrices, you missed the 2 out again.
I think you're right, actually, but I was wondering what happened to that.
Everyone wanted to check J-fax, so that should be 2 I-sigma. Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
2 I, that's not an idea, so sigma J.
Sigma I, because it was sigma J, you think it should be 2 I, final I, J, K.
You say that in your J's, when you define the J for over 2, they obey the right.
Yes, thank you. Put the factor of 2 in. You're absolutely right. I was puzzled by that when I was looking at it. I thought, in my notes, it did not have a factor of 2, and I wondered why.